It's Sunday afternoon and time once again for Wordplay here on Asheville FM. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and we are once again honored today to have co-host Kathy Smith Bowers on board with her very special guest, Susan Leffler.
Thank you, as always, Jeff Davis, for sharing this hour of Wordplay, and many thanks to the North Carolina Arts Council for making this Laureate's Hour possible. I'm very excited to have with us today Susan Leffler, who has traveled all the way from Brevard, North Carolina. I came to know Susan through the Great Smokies writing program and was immediately drawn to not only her powerful poems, but also her compassion, her huge heart, and her delightfully generous spirit. Susan is a past editor of Smoky Mountain Living magazine and soon to be author of her first book of poems, Rendering the Bones, due out in summer of 2011 by Wind Publications in Kentucky. Susan, welcome.
Thank you, Kathy. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, we are thrilled to have you, Susan. It's just a joy. Susan, I know you've worked long and hard on this book while juggling a lot of other jobs and responsibilities. Can you talk to us a little bit about the joys and the struggles of bringing this book together?
Yes. It's been a lot of years. Mm-hmm. I have four children, and like most people who write poetry, I suppose I had always written poetry from the time I can remember almost. But when our youngest daughter went to first grade, I decided that I was going to begin to really study. And I studied with Ken Shamley, who's a professor mm-hmm. and poet at Brevard College. And was in a group and very serious about it. But four children, they grow up and it gets more complicated mm-hmm. as you go. Mm-hmm. And so in the 90s, I joined the North Carolina Writers Network. And I believe it was 99, perhaps. It met in Asheville, and Catherine Stripling Byer read mm-hmm. from her book Black Shawl. Mm. And it was one of those experiences of feeling as if the earth had moved.
Right.
And that writing poems was somehow something deeper than just a casual pastime, or could mm-hmm. be, if it could
wasn't
have that
just
kind
a hobby
of
anymore.
No, it felt to me like more like a calling, mm-hmm. and I couldn't chase her down that night, so I chased her down by phone mm-hmm. and asked her if she was teaching anywhere, and she was teaching at the John C. Campbell Folk School, a master class, and I sent her some poems, and she graciously let me join, mm-hmm. and that was really, I think, the beginning of a more maybe focused journey mm-hmm. toward work in poetry. From that point, I discovered Hindman in Kentucky, the Appalachian Writers mm-hmm. Workshop there. Studied with Kay first mm-hmm. there, and I think that's where I first met you.
It is indeed.
And then later, maybe a year or so later, I think, you were teaching at the Great Smoky Mountain Writers Program. Mm-hmm. And really, for me, the idea of a book, I think, had been such a vast idea before that point. Mm-hmm. But when I took your class, you did the chapbook,
yes.
the little mini chapbook.
At the end of each semester.
Five or six poems, mm-hmm. and they were things that we had worked on as a group and had revised and revised. But the thing that was a breakthrough for me was you took this tiny group of poems that you hadn't been thinking, oh, yes, this is a mm-hmm. body of work.
You were just writing one poem
to
and
turn
then
it
another
in.
Poem. And mm-hmm.
Right, and not thinking of any real connection.
Right.
But because you were inspiring us to create a little chapbook from it, suddenly you could see the connections. Mm-hmm. And so I think I may have taken three, four, I don't know how many classes with
yes.
you. And I have to say, not to embarrass you or anything, but you do have a great gift of empowering people and kind
embarrass
of
me, embarrass me, Susan.
Just allowing people to feel that they can, mm. they can reach for something. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was an enormous help to me with my personality was that you would always say, don't set out to write a poem.
Right.
Just sit down and write whatever image you can't get out of your mind.
Right.
But
begin
don't be thinking about poem. Mm-hmm. Which was an
enormous...
Because
you'll immediately get writer's block if you do.
Oh, of
course.
That's
in my experience.
You immediately say to yourself, but this doesn't work. This
right.
isn't any good before you
mm-hmm.
even put a word yep. on the page.
Absolutely.
And then I guess, you actually helped me. I submitted a full chapbook to a competition and got I think I was first runner-up or something, but they only published one. And so that chapbook kind of went out for about a year or so. And then I had the opportunity to study with David Wagner at the Whidbey Island Writers.
Wow.
It's actually a low residency program, but they mm-hmm. allow other people to come in and study when they're
right.
on campus. And David Wagner was quite something. It was a little like being in the room with the ghost of Dylan Thomas and
right.
Theodore Retke, and because he knew all those people
mm-hmm.
and all the stories and all the poems by heart, it felt to me like.
And especially being in that geographical environment, too, must have been pretty magical and mystical.
It was very magical.
Mm-hmm.
Whidbey Island is quite a place. And it was also a wonderful thing to get exposed to a whole nother region of poets.
Mm-hmm.
Marvin Bell is out there, Copper Canyon Press.
Mm-hmm.
Tess Gallagher spoke yeah. and taught at one of the workshops.
Because that's Raymond Carver territory,
yes.
isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And she was actually talking at the time about her work to, get the versions of his work that she feels were
mm-hmm.
more authentic
yeah.
published.
Right.
And she's a delight. Mm-hmm. So I came back from studying with David Wagner and for some reason just decided I wanted to move into a full-length book.
Mm-hmm.
And
after four or five chapbooks in the Great Smokies, you had a good many to choose from.
I did. I just felt that it was time, and you encouraged me in that way, as did Kay Byer, and also encouraged me to think that I didn't have to have a book with 150 poems in it necessarily.
Right.
And so I spent a year pulling that together and then sending it out, which, of course, is a rather demoralizing process.
Oh, yes.
And...
But it makes it so much sweeter when it finally happens.
Well, it's just kind of remarkable because when it finally happened, it happened very quickly. Charlie spent some time, the editor and publisher mm-hmm. of Wind, with the manuscript and said, I knew I wanted to publish it before I had finished reading it, which I thought was pretty thrilling. And so far, he hasn't changed his mind, even though I trust that he has now finished reading it after several months.
I got a feeling he's not going to change his mind.
I don't think so.
Wow.
So I guess that's really the story. But along the way, life happens, and
mm-hmm.
your children and your family
yeah.
are getting married and having babies, and your parents are getting older and not well, and
right.
all of that.
And now you're going to have this marvelous book that's got to keep you floating for a while. And if it doesn't, I'll call you up and remind you to float some more, Susan.
Well, I'm really excited. And one of the things that I'm thrilled about is the remarkable photographer Bill Lee, who specializes in bears and has published books on Cades Cove and Wildflower of the Forest, Wildflower book.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those are his all of those are his photographs. I wrote to him and asked him if he had any photographs that he thought might fit the title, mm-hmm. Rendering the Bones. And he sent me several and has given me permission to use one for the cover. So I'm really happy about that.
Well, I am so excited about soon having that book to hold in my hand, Susan, because I have watched you, and I've told you before, when this book is ready, and you don't want to do a book, and I say this to anybody, and from my own experience, I worked 13 years before my first book came out, and I'm so glad that it did not get accepted in some of those earlier incarnations. I mean, yeah. Somebody was protecting me from myself. So this will be a book that you will never, you know, we hear a lot of people say that, poets say that you end up being ashamed of your first book. But you'll never be ashamed of Rendering the Bones, because I know those poems in it, and I just cannot wait to have it in my hands. It's going to be a powerful
Thank you.
Book.
And, you know, one of the things as you were talking that I was thinking of was that you and I decided together when you were helping me with the chapbook initially mm-hmm. about that title, mm-hmm. taking that poem's title. And as I've lived with that title, I've really enjoyed so much all of the layers of the word render.
I love saying it, Rendering the Bones. I mean, who would not pick up a book of poems called Rendering the Bones? Wow.
You know, it means offer, but it also means to tear apart, to boil down. I mean, there are just so many transformational levels to that word.
I just love it. It gives me goosebumps just to think about it. Well, Susan, so your subjects and themes are, you do explore the family and the personal.
Right.
And then also the political. Where did you first become interested in subjects such as, you know, that are more the bigger world? Your interest in the environment comes across. Your interest in the things that are happening in other parts of the world, horrible things. I myself am scared to tackle big subjects like that, but you're not, and you do it well, and I really admire you for that. So how does this does this book include all both kinds of poems, the personal, the private, and then do you move into the larger world and the more political, bigger stuff?
Well, it yes, I would say yes, except that I'm kind of afraid to tackle it too. And so the poems that we are talking about being more public, so to speak, poems or about issues that concern, you know, all of us. Most of those poems were inspired by some very specific small detail. Mm-hmm. For instance, a picture of a group of women going to get water with these huge jars balanced on their heads, or stories about, well, there's a poem in there about Einstein on his 100th birthday, mm-hmm. because there were just these utterly delightful stories mm-hmm. about him. Mm-hmm. You know, when the bees started dying, that was just felt to me so threatening. But then when I actually came to write the poem, I used a little note that I found, a little news note about the bees, you know, at the top. Mm-hmm. So they usually stay very focused on the detail.
They move that saying, the way to the universal is through the particular. And that's why you handle the bigger subjects so well, because you do get to the universal through the particular. I know that I remember one of your poems that had to do with Katrina.
Yes.
And I think there was that the poem about the melting violins?
Yep. A family who actually moved to Asheville, and she was a concert violinist. Yes.
Right. So it's not just you get to the horrors of what happened to all of those people during Katrina, but you get to that through a very particular instance.
And I think one of the things that's been on my mind since last summer, our friend Diane Gilliam, the remarkable poet from Ohio, was teaching in Kentucky, and she talked about the calling of poets to speak into the silences, to speak into places where either no one is noticed or where the people involved can't speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. And we know there are lots of those places in our culture. So
I love that. Speak into the silences. speak into the silences. Well, you sure do that.
Here in the Season of Silences, you are listening to Wordplay. Here, once again, Kathy Smith Bowers and her guest, Susan Leffler.
Susan, your book, Rendering the Bones, is divided into three sections, right?
Right.
And the first section, I believe, does explore more of the private or... And not certainly that those, even those private personal poems, not that they also don't get to the bigger universal stuff, because if they didn't, they wouldn't be in this book, because they simply would not go beyond you and your private experience.
Right.
But you do have that first section that deals with childhood, young adult themes, right?
Right. Right.
Well, talk to us a little bit about that section and share with us some of the poems in it, if you will.
Well, I would love to. The epigraph at the beginning of that section is a quote from Theodore Retke's Journey to the Interior, and it is, "In the long journey out of the self, there are many detours, washed out, interrupted, raw places."
And I got to hear that one more time.
In the long journey out of the self, there are many detours, washed out, interrupted, raw places.
Mm.
And for anyone who's listening who knows anything of Theodore Retke's story, they know that he was a man of enormous gifts, enormous tenderness and power, and yet also a very troubled
yes.
man. And I think that he knew a lot about those raw places.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for me, it feels always in life there are so many detours. And if we can just give ourselves enough hope to think that we're going to make that turn mm-hmm. and come back mm-hmm. to the main road. Mm-hmm. But when we're in a detour sometimes, you know how it is on the highway. And
oh,
you
yeah.
take a detour and then
right.
you can't find the next sign.
And you know, if we can... get to a place where we can realize that it is actually that detour that's going to be crucial
yes.
in our becoming, you know, the people we're meant to be.
Which
if you can ever get to that point.
It's a very hard thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Because we have our dreams and our agendas,
that's
and
right.
then it feels mm-hmm. like we're being derailed
that's
sometimes.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, the first one in the book is called Drawing from Inside Out,
mm-hmm.
and it is a poem that really emerged from a period, about 5 or 6 years ago. A friend of mine who's an artist said to me, anybody can learn to draw, and I mm-hmm. said, But she ended up inspiring me to take a class in Asheville, and what I found was that it is remarkable how the world changes when an artist starts helping you know how to look at it, how to look at, you know, empty spaces and light and dark and line and borders. And so this poem, Drawing from Inside Out, really grew out of that experience. Instead of drawing edges, draw the heart of the thing. Close your eyes and snap a mental picture. The inside of a barking dog, the pulsing heat in an 18-wheeler's engine, the filament within the bulb. Draw sap coursing through leaf veins, seeds splitting deep underground. Draw the oak's most inner rings, the robin's thoughts who sees the world between two blades of grass. Nothing much compared to how it looks from air. Draw the hurricane of blossoms from the eye of the tree before it tosses petals to the ground. Draw snakes like the ones the painter found in your porch ceiling, roiling and tumbling, night after night hissing and levitating, spending themselves as they wait. Draw your life from inside out, the forgotten pebble, the rare coin, a note in the pocket of old jeans.
Wow. Beautiful, Susan.
Thank you.
Wow. That hurricane of blossoms. Are you going to use that line?
That is the quintessential Kathy Smith-Bowers honoring the poet question.
That's right. Are you going to use that line?
Well, the next poem I'd like to read from this first section is actually a poem that... came from an experience I had as a very young child, well, 8. At this stage, that feels very young. And it's called Killing Can. My friend Martha had a killing can and a preacher father who punished her with silence. When a squirrel she tried to catch bit through her dainty thumbnail, Martha's father did not speak to her for days. Tall like an awkward bird, hair curled tightly under, glasses curved like silver wings, Martha kept her mouth a closed, thin line. One day we found a chrysalis and put it in a jar. Months passed. At last we watched the wings emerge, folded and wet, saw that he had no mouth. Watched his tenuous stretch, scarlet over black, imagined the lifting. She put him in the killing can and closed the lid. He beat his wings to tatters as he died. Martha must be nearly 60 now. I wonder if her mouth is still as thin, her fingers slender as they were back then, when she cradled the killing can and opened up the lid.
That chills me to the bones.
It was a very chilly household that Martha lived in.
Wow.
I never quite figured it out.
Mm.
Unlike my very bombastic household.
Wow.
Well, this poem is also from very early in my childhood, and I was lucky enough to have a childhood lived partly on a farm with my grandparents, a farm that I still is in our family and that I love dearly. And like most rural southern families, everybody lived down one little road or other quite close. And my Aunt Bess, who was my grandfather's sister, youngest sister, so she was really my great aunt, Aunt Bess, of course, we said. anyway, she lived.
I used to have an aunt. Her name was Bright. How would you like to be called Aunt Bright?
Aunt Bright. Bulb burnout. So this poem is called Bess. Aunt Bess wore no underwear beneath her feed sack dress. When she stood in the sun, you could see right through. I would walk down the dirt track past three tobacco barns to the porch where she sat awash in the bruised smell of ripe gardenias. Marooned among galvanized tubs, I took down her hair, brushed and braided the waist-length mass, while she told how she poured red devil lye on a wart and burned it off. At 20, Bess married a coarse-faced man called Uncle Tom, who kept his razor strap by the door. One day, he pulled me onto his lap and pawed at my leg. I stayed away from him, except when he lowered the bucket into the well, reeled it up, and handed me the gourd. Sharp, tanged water missed my mouth, sloshing dirty feet. At 50, Aunt Bess chased her sister around the room with a butcher knife. They sent her to the asylum where she stayed 10 years. She never told me that story, or how she got cured and came home to ripe gardenias and Uncle Tom's pig-eyed squint and the mad old rooster who patrolled the broom-swept yard. Family
Susan,
stories.
Do you think we might have been twins separated at birth and then a...
I think maybe everybody who's lucky has some crazy somewhere.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Wow. I mean, even that your description of her dress, and that was my grandmother.
And by the time I knew her, I have to say, my Aunt Bess was quite a lovely and emotionally settled person again. But I knew just enough of those stories as I got older.
to keep your guard up.
Well, I wasn't so guarded with her, but Uncle Tom was another matter. So the last poem from this section actually is a poem that you have had a rather intimate connection with, because it happened in that same farmhouse that I grew up in. And you were with me the night that this occurred.
That's why one of the reasons I loved hearing that poem you just read, because I could see the house. I know that wonderful house. I could move into that wonderful house as long as they got the snake out.
Right. So this poem is called Dear Snake. 6 feet of diamond skin wrapped tight as packing cord around the little chest of drawers that was my mother's. When did you invade the room where I will sleep this one last night, the room my grandparents slept in their whole lives? I jerk the bed from the wall to look for you, dreading what I will find. I see only your shit. Well then, you're cleansed outside and in. Have you slid through the grate and gone to search for mice? I cannot sleep for wondering where you are and what it is you seek, whether you might return. What is it like to crawl from your own mouth, leaving crystal tangles on the floor? Do you see more clearly then with new transparent eyes? Do you feel the stones more sharply with your slick, bright skin? Do you find new smells to savor, whole new creatures sweet on the tongue, fresh shapes to wrap in your embrace? Tell me, dear snake, are you afraid?
That poem does bring back memories, Susan.
It does, doesn't it?
I couldn't figure out why Susan would be afraid of a snake's skin until you told me, because a snake that is still alive crawled out of that skin.
And we had no clue how far he might have been away from us at the time. Thanks to your trusty dog, however.
Oh, that's right.
We did assume that.
That's right. Manna was there.
Yes, the watch dog.
Well, I tell you what, Susan, that's the first section, or a few poems from the first section. If you can maintain that, and I know you can, this is going to be a real winner. Really, those are powerful, powerful
points.
Thank
you.
You're listening to Wordplay. Here, once again, Kathy Smith Bowers and her guest, Susan Leffler.
So the second section, some of these poems venture a little more out into
right.
the public arena.
Right.
Tell us
right.
about that section.
They do. Well, I actually, the epigraph is from E.E. Cummings, who's a poet that I love and admire. This is actually from his 6 non-lectures, which he you can still get, and they're marvelous. They're not poems. They're mm-hmm. they're from lectures mm-hmm. that he did. And the quote is, "Oh, we are all so very full of knowing that we are empty, empty of understanding."
Mm.
And so I think, you know, the more I go along, I see the wisdom, and it's in every great religion, although I think we often associate it, for instance, with Zen Buddhism, mm-hmm. because they tend to name the fact that we can't know.
No.
Mm-hmm. But especially empty of understanding. You know, the world is such a ragged, wild place, mm-hmm. and it does. I'm not sure we can understand mm-hmm. it. And so there's a quote, Alan Jones, this marvelous priest who spoke at a conference I was at a month ago. He said, "I'm more and more convinced there is a deep charity at the heart of all things."
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, when we look at these difficult things in the world, and I'm the original pessimist, so it's hard for me to remember that. But I think it helps to remember that, you know, and to respond as though that really is true.
Well, Susan, I certainly don't see you as a pessimist, but if you say you are...
It's because you're so much fun. I can't kind of get it going when I'm hanging out with you. But the poem I'd like to read, the first one from this section that I'd like to read, actually happened on Whidbey Island. And so I was able to work with David Wagner on this poem. But it was one of these events that I didn't know at all any detail. We were staying in this beautiful yoga lodge, and suddenly a stranger appeared in a tent on the lawn. Now, we made the assumption this person might have been, we didn't know, a woman who was, you know, in danger from mm-hmm. someone and was mm-hmm. in a safe house or a homeless. We didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But there she was, sharing our space. So this is called Woman in Backyard, and the epigraph is from The Rose by Yeats. "Take, if you must, this little bag of dreams, unloose the cord, and they will wrap you round."
Mm.
She's pitched her tent just there, behind the inn, surrounded by wizened apple trees, cast about with charms to hold hard times at bay. The cloud of silk ripples above her head, held fast with poles and guy ropes anchored to the ground. What has she found? She's brought her cat and dog and carries on a conversation as she lights her lamp and thinks about the recent losing of things. Does she listen to wood sigh, the owls, the snap of deer breaking for the dark? Does she risk the night to see the stars? Each morning she steps from her blue dome, in her blue robe and floppy slippers, avoids the dime-sized frogs careening through the grass. She ducks her head when I greet her, like the blue-tailed skink who suns himself on the garden wall. In the tents we make as children, sheets stretch taut across the chairs, we dream of being grown and all that freedom. Imaginary rooms fill up with dolls and teddy bears who speak only the words we give them. Maybe she's furnished her tent with flowers, a little table, a chipped cup, setting a place for herself no one can steal. The tinted silk looks like a parachute, something to carry her swiftly, gently down, past storms and wind to safety on the ground.
That is such a gorgeous segue into your own childhood experience and then back. That's a beautiful poem to illustrate that quote by Diane's quote about writing into the silences, mm-hmm. because this is definitely an outsider looking in and trying to look into the mystery of who this woman is, how she came to be there. Beautiful. Just beautiful.
Thank you. It was a bit of a magical feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the next poem is perhaps an even better example of what you were asking me about responding to more exterior mm-hmm. or things that could be maybe considered political or mm-hmm. And it actually grew not really from a newscast, you know, this is the poet's lie a lot part, mm-hmm. but from a newspaper photograph. But it's called Women Bearing Water. This afternoon, I swam in a blue pool where water fountains glisten and sprinklers soak the tennis courts. At home, I watered herbs with a green hose, touch buttons to wash dishes, clothes. I stood beneath the shower. Water rushed and gurgled in and out. Later, I watched six women on the news, each with an enormous jar balanced on head or shoulder, only hands and faces showing beneath the veils. Trees scrawled bleak messages behind their backs. I saw their toes as they walked in sandals to fetch water. The jars must be so heavy when they are full. Mothers must berate their children for spilling even one drop, dreading the hollow tone of empty jar, the children's dusty skin when they must take up the jars again and walk and walk.
Another wonderful example of that segue between the personal, the experiences of the speaker of the poem, those little quotidian, you know, day-to-day things, and then these women. That image of the trees, I almost, you know, I had my... Sometimes a line is so wonderful that I have to force myself to continue listening because that line grabs me. What is that beautiful line again, Susan, about the trees behind them scrawled?
Trees scrawled bleak messages behind their backs.
Wow.
And there's something about feet, you know, there's something amazing about feet and water. And I learned recently that in those cultures, in India particularly, it was an Indian wedding that I was looking at pictures of, and they also wash the feet of the bride and groom. The family mm. washes their feet, mm. which of course is a very ancient Christian symbol of humility
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
So, you know, just somehow those images seem to just pile on each other, the feet and the mm. water and, you know, the endless walking that they have to do.
Well, you certainly do shine a light on the power of those images. Beautiful.
Thank you. Well, shall I read the bees?
Absolutely.
The poem is called Who Will Heal the Bees? Who Will Heal the Bees? And This is one of those things when you said you're afraid to tackle. That's how mm-hmm. I feel. And this particular thing was such a big mystery, really. But then I just started researching it a little bit. And online, I found this little news note. By the time John Miller realized just how many of his bees were dying, the almonds were in bloom, and there was nothing to be done.
That in itself is a poem.
It felt that way to me, yeah. For sure. Starting the day with honey heavy on my tongue, I picture dizzy flight to sourwood trees high on the mountain, where bees tunnel into heavy blossoms, legs burdened with pollen. I remember honey in the frame my grandfather brought and scraped into jars to store. Now bees wander in drunken circles near the hives, dying by the thousands. Others disappear, dwindling, they call it. No one knows where the workers go, leaving their queen to her hapless, hungry fate. Hauled from farm to poison trees, the bees are stressed, depressed, their colonies collapse, they can't resist the mites. Who will heal them? Who will come in dazzling robes to heal the bees? Wind blows cold, and we are growing old, forgetting all the damage we have done, forgetting what the old folks say. When death has come, we have to tell the bees.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, you know, Susan, it's very clear that, you know, in all of the poems that you just read us that did move out into the public world, there's that little personal element that particular bigger image or image outside of you touched on and just sort of lit a little fire. And that's beautiful. That's just beautiful. You give me hope. Give me hope. Maybe I can write.
I do believe that the jury is spoken, Kathy Smith Bowers.
Listening to Wordplay on Asheville FM. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. And here once again are Kathy Smith Bowers and her guest, Susan Leffler.
Well, so Susan, your section three then, you deal a lot with adulthood, especially aging, the things that we have to deal with as we age, and especially with loss and the loss of our parents.
Right.
Tell us some more about, does this section have an epigraph?
It does. And the epigraph is from Elizabeth Bishop's One Art, The Art of Losing Isn't Hard to Master. Mm-hmm. I guess we could maybe argue that point. you know, in some ways the art of losing never gets easy. Mm-hmm. But since we have no choice, I that feels to me like a line that fits. Mm-hmm. And as an only child, the intensity of 10 years of my parents aging and the dying was felt quite engulfing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, especially if you know the final line of that poem, of course, the whole idea is, well, it is hard to master.
Right, right.
What a great epigraph.
Right.
Yeah. I hope the people who read your book will also look up the full poems of these marvelous poets that you're bringing us to.
Yeah, that would be a good, and that one particularly will be easy for people to get hold of. I'd like just to kind of frame this to read, I'd like to read one that related to when my mom was dying, and then I'd like to read the title poem, and then I have one actual funny poem about a cemetery, and then one last one that I'd like to read. So this one is called Today's News. My mother dies and dies, and I forget the reasons why I want her here, trying to work my life around the full stop of her death and what comes after. I try to think how it will be, how she will be, how on earth my father will be. I try to think how to behave with her, as if dying were something we might fail, might be forced to repeat. The remedial dying class. Mm. Yeah. I search for words, a manual perhaps, hoping to find balance, hoping to find a piece of solid ground. The New York Times spreads across the floor, earthquakes, floods, explosions, obituaries honoring the dead. I search the pages for last words, last breath, last fond embrace. City blocks, stockpiles, warehouses full of words, heap at my feet with nothing like assurance.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
So this is the cemetery poem. Mm-hmm. And you know, every now and then you just see a sign that is just way too good to be true. So we were driving down the road one day, and sure enough, at a little cemetery, there was a sign that announced, no perpetual care.
Be warned.
So, sign in cemetery. No weeds pulled, no grass mowed, no tombstones dusted. No dead flowers cleared, all care strictly temporary. After a certain point, we do not promise tears or eulogies. We leave the dead to their own devices. If they wish to burst from their polished boxes, silk-lined caskets, their fine steel vaults, that is their own affair. If they wish to catch up on the latest gossip, compare their notes on boredom, protest the lack of perpetual care, which, we hasten to say, we announced in advance, then they must rise up and state their case, cease their incessant complaining, recognize they're on their own to scheme or plan or dream, like my mother, with her pen and paper lined with possibilities and all the time in the world at last.
Oh, well, you know, it's absolutely hilarious, but then you make that little turn at the end, Susan, like my mother, you know.
It's just,
There's that little thread, you know, why that sign struck you the way it did.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's kind of funny when I think now the sort of sadness I feel that I'm not living in my hometown. And so, you know, unlike the people in the old days who all went on decoration day to see about the graves and so on, I don't get there very often. Yeah. So, well, I'd like to read the title poem.
I'd love
for
you to.
And then at least maybe I've got two more marked, but we'll
Absolutely.
See. It's called Rendering the Bones. The trouble with grief, I think, as I boil the bones, is that you grow accustomed to it. empty space where all you have left is old dry bones. At the rest home where my father lives, his neighbors peddle their wheeled chairs like little boats along the halls, their eyes empty as hooked fish. These old ones know dry bones don't live. Against her shriveled breast, an old woman clutches her plastic doll, touches its cheek, and croons to it. Her reedy cry follows me down the narrow hallways of our loss, where I hear her again as I stand at my stove, clutching my mother's spoon in my hands, rendering the bones.
And that is exactly what you're doing with all of the poems in this book. Susan, you're rendering the bones. You are rendering the bones. That is so beautiful. That image of the eyes so empty. That was another image that stopped me just because of its brilliance and the stunning nature of it.
And you know how you feel in those settings. Just, you know each of these people has such a history, and but you're probably not going to be able to learn it.
Right. Yeah.
So, well, before I read the last one, if there's time still to read one, I'd like to read a poem about the end of my father's life, or at least right after his death. It's one of those events that I still can hardly believe happened, but a friend of ours flew his body from the mountains to the Piedmont. My father was a pilot, and it was quite an amazing event. So it's called Collected. After my father dies, I try on things. His wedding ring, my mother's diamond he wore until he died. The ring pressed deep and deeper into the flesh of his bent finger. I make lists of things to celebrate the life of a collector, models of the planes he flew and wore, scaled to fit neatly on the palm, foam core and glue and pins, so I can recreate the missing man formation, dead roses to strip petals for his grave. The lists continue. A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing, and the Navy hymn, for those in peril on the sea, in case the bulwark fails us after all. And verses from the Bible that he read in college and never read again. We collect the body board, with my father wrapped in a sheet and tied, drive to the airstrip, tailgate open to make room for the feet. We bind the body in a flag with bungee cords. My son lifts him over the wing and in for the last flight home. Our friend taxis down the runway in the plane he calls Skydancer, takes off between two mountains, circles, and dips his wings.
Wow.
Two pilots. So, this might be the only poem in this collection that I don't believe you actually maybe have seen. I'm not sure. it's called About Ashes. Ash Wednesday in the church, I listen to the ancient words of dust and grief, punctuated with the hiss of oxygen. Words crunch in my mouth like little bones. Slow bodies move forward to the rail, kneel, submit to ashes marked on skin, remembering the palm green fronds, the bloom, the fire that brought them here. At home, I shovel ashes from the hearth until I fill a scuttle full, the very one my grandfather used to load coal from the towering pile next to the chicken yard, piece by piece, to keep the grate alive. I load the remnants of dead trees into a heap and haul them to the yard. I'll feed the lilacs with them. They like ashes. When the shovel lifts for the last time, one spark smolders still, telling the tale once more of who we were, of who we long to be, of what it means to come awake and waking see.
Is that the final poem?
No, it's actually the next to the last poem.
Because that works so wonderfully with just the title, Rendering the Bones, because you allude to the bones again in that,
right.
And then you've got those ashes. And so this just feels to me like a book that it just seems to be organized so beautifully. You know, I love what Robert Frost once said, that in a book of 25 poems, the book itself should be poem number 26.
Okay,
and Susan,
cool.
This is what this feels like to me, that the whole book is the final poem. You just have done an amazing job. And
well, thank you. You know, when you say that, I think... You were talking earlier about a book, you know, not doing something before it's ready.
Yes.
And I think between the time that I first put it together, mm-hmm. and the time this revision got submitted last summer, it really did go through quite an upheaval.
Yeah.
And some poems were dropped, some were added, mm-hmm. but the organization shifted. And so it feels to me like it was going through a process that it needed to go through.
It was trying to become the book it needed to be, if you would just let it, give it time. And thank goodness you did, Susan, because...
Because I had no choice.
Well, the universe was looking out for you. The universe was taking care of you.
Well,
really.
Thanks to people like you, who didn't let me... bury my head entirely in the ground every time.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I really mean it. I can't wait to hold this book in my hand, Susan. Now, so here's the big question. What are you working on now?
Well, I have, of course, like all writers, lots of different projects. I may be doing another Brevard history, which with Arcadia Publishing, they've mm-hmm. been asking, mm-hmm. and I'm about to agree. But I've been...
All right, now tell us a little bit about the Brevard history.
They do photographic histories of various communities, and I did one about 4 years ago, actually longer ago, 2004 it was, a history of Transylvania, or Brevard, mm-hmm. But primarily with pictures and deep captions mm-hmm. is the idea, mm-hmm. old pictures. Mm-hmm. But they have a series called Then and Now, which is kind of intriguing to me because it has to do with the old picture and history combined with what it has become.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm working on some things for children, but the poems have been really lately very immediate for me and kind of helping me survive whatever it is I'm going through at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh, yeah.
Actually, the one of the ones I brought, which we probably don't have time for, but it's called Death by Bittersweet.
Well, do we? Let's do it.
Let's see. Got it right here, I think. Death by Bittersweet. Invasive, eating up the mountains. It twines above the entrance to the garden, and I long for it. Warned against illicit spread, we strip branches, pile them high in the pickup. I climb in with clippers and a glass of wine, arrange vine after vine in wood-fired pots until fire engine berries blaze like sun breaking shades of cloud apart. The vine is bitter and its berries poison, yet to the birds they're sweet. I find a berry floating in the wine, and think what a perfect death the drink would bring. Like learning every joy casts shadows, and an ending haunts each start, seeing how our hearts will cling to the devouring of exquisite and invasive things.
Well, you know, Susan, this may be a little premature, but I think that might be the title poem of your second book, Death by Bittersweet. And that's like Rendering the Bones. Who could see a book called Death by Bittersweet and not take it down off the shelf and open it? Well, and also that the metaphor that you so beautifully arrive at the end of that poem just opens up all kinds of possibilities for dealing with this theme, which you're going to do, Susan, since, yeah.
It is interesting. Somebody that I just read, and I can't remember what poet it was, but was talking about how the rhythm drives you toward revelation. Mm-hmm. How, you know, when mm-hmm. you eventually move into that space where something is happening with the structure or the music,
uh-huh.
and then you end up in a space that you couldn't have thought out.
Absolutely.
Ever.
Yep. Absolutely. Susan Loeffler, congratulations on this beautiful book. It was a long time in coming, and it's your lucky readers are going to see why.
Thank you.
Because it is just exquisite. So thank you for coming, and thank you
thank
for being
you.
Here. And do you have, it's probably too early, of course, to have readings, but you will be giving readings, and I'm sure there will be announcements for that. And if you will remind us, Jefferson Davis and I will remind our audience where you will be giving readings from this book.
I will for sure let you know.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks so much. All right.